Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined down the line by Toby Harnden, the award-winning author and veteran foreign correspondent. Dead Men Risen was Toby's account of beleaguered British soldiers fighting desperately to prevent the Taliban from seizing Afghanistan's Helmand province, and it winning the Orwell Prize. As a former foreign correspondent, he's reported from 33 countries, covering Belfast, Baghdad, and Washington, D.C., for the Daily Telegraph, Daily Mail, and the Sunday Times. He was imprisoned in Zimbabwe and faced prosecution in Northern Ireland for his work, a dual U.S. and U.K. citizen, and a former Royal Navy officer. Toby lives in Virginia. Toby, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Paul. Great to be with you.
The honour and the pleasure is mine. Now, what an incredible career. We're going to have to make this a seven-hour podcast, aren't we, to take it all in? let's start, if we may, then, with your most recent book, First Casualty. It's the dramatic true story of the CIA's Team Alpha, the first Americans to be dropped behind enemy lines in Afghanistan after 9/11.
Yeah, so I'm very proud of it. I was in Washington, D.C. on 9/11 for, you know, like so many people, almost everybody, really, you know, it changed my life, you know, it changed the world. And so this is very much a 9/11 book. It starts on 9/11, and one member of the CIA team is flying from Tashkent to Heathrow. Another is underwater at the Special Forces Diving School in Key West, Florida. And another, Mike Spann, who was killed on November 25th, 2001, was in CIA headquarters. And so it's a sort of a character-driven narrative of what America did and what the CIA in particular, that was sort of leading the fight nearly 21 years ago, did. And, you know, I feel that in some ways it's something I've lived over the last two decades, you know, in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And I wanted to go back to the beginning and get the sort of the story from the protagonists who were actually there in those sort of incredible sort of early days when, you know, ironically, there was a considerable degree of success and a formula that kind of worked. And I think, you know, one of the tragic ironies really is that because it worked so well, the mission expanded and it became sort of nation building and 100,000 American troops instead of, you know, hundreds of CIA officers and Green Berets.
It's a very visceral book. It places you right with Team Alpha as they ride into battle on horseback.
What I've tried to do, I think it was the case in Bandit Country, you know, about the IRA in South Armagh, which is my first book, which was published, while I'm making myself feel old, 99, you know, 23 years ago. And Dead Men Risen is sort of the gritty, dark underbelly of war. You know, what happens in combat, the sort of the bravery, but also the cowardice, you know, the things that go right, but the many things that go wrong, the chaos, the psychology, the emotions, the fear. And so I really wanted to do that through, I wanted to get down to that level with Team Alpha. I mean, it was sort of an incredible journey in itself to find these people because obviously they were all CIA officers or retired. One is still serving, actually. But I interviewed all six of them in the end who were surviving. So Mike Spann was killed and Mark Rausenberg, who was the medic, died in the Philippines in 2016 on CIA duty. So six of them still alive, one still serving, who eventually I got permission from the CIA to interview, a guy called Andy. But the others, I just sort of tracked them down, you know, persuaded them to talk to me. Some of them sort of talked to me just right off the bat. Others needed sort of persuasion and sort of other validators. A couple sort of wanted the CIA to give them the okay that, you know, that they weren't going to lose their security clearances, you know, as contractors or whatever. But, you know, it became a very sort of intimate thing where I spent many, many hours with these guys. And COVID, weirdly, I think in some ways helped because a lot of people were sort of isolated and had time on their hands. And also these people were not fearful people, so they weren't worried about, you know, masks and, you know, and not seeing anybody or hiding away. But, you know, I felt that I was able to sort of, you know, go several levels deeper than I had before in, say, you know, Dead Men Risen, for instance, with, you know, British soldiers in Helmand, and just and talk about getting in the position where I could sort of transport the readers through this story, through the eyes and sort of emotions of the protagonist, which was, you know, it was a great feeling to be able to, you know, I believe, you know, pull that off.
What's the impact been like?
Well, so it's been interesting. I mean, you know, obviously there's different kind of levels. And so in some ways, the thing that I'm proudest of is that I think it's helped some of these members of Team Alpha, some of the Green Berets, some of the SBS people who were there, some of the air crew. I think it's helped them sort of come to terms with what's happened, because they were there, but they had kind of sometimes literally sort of tunnel vision, and they didn't know how it all sort of fitted together. And so there was a point in the research, and this has happened previously, it happened with Dead Men Risen, where you start giving as well as taking. And so somebody says, oh, you know, I think I was doing this, and I was doing this, and I think such and such was doing that, and then this happened, and I don't really know why. And I say, actually, I think the reason that happened was this, because I'd spoken to other people who, you know, had different sort of parts. And then they're like, oh, okay, yeah. And so, you know, this was incredibly emotional and, you know, gut-wrenching in many ways. Mike Spann was killed. I mean, David Tyson in particular, he was the CIA case officer, so traditional spy, former academic, linguist. No, he was not an elite warrior, but he was suddenly in this position of where, you know, Mike had been killed with these 400 Al-Qaeda prisoners in this uprising in this fort. So, you know, the shit had really hit the fan. And David had to step up, and he had to function, and he had to kill or be killed. And he killed a lot of people. And so he has all these emotions of sort of survivor's guilt. Did he do the right thing? He completed a successful career in the CIA. He went back to his family, but, you know, still has nightmares, still kind of is searching for the missing pieces. Like he talks about like the almost like God's video of what happened. And he told me that a therapist had told him that it, you know, that video doesn't exist. It's been wiped from the hard drive. But, you know, I was able to assemble the closest to that that I think is possible. And I think it's helped David reconnect with some other members of the team on a sort of a deeper level, appreciate what they did, and sort of come to terms with what happened. And that, to me, if there was nothing else, you know, that would make the book worth it. But I think it's also given a perspective to people at the end of 20 years of war, which obviously, you know, ended miserably, of how it began, why it began, obviously 9/11 and Al-Qaeda and bin Laden and, you know, all those things that so many people have forgotten, and a formula that sort of that worked. And so I think it's given people a fresh perspective from 20 years ago that was just something that just, you know, quickly passed through the news cycle. I feel that it's a valuable contribution to history and understanding of this war. And, you know, that's another thing I wanted to achieve.
I mean, these military stories are obviously very deeply personal to you because you spent a decade in the armed forces yourself with the Royal Navy. How did your military training help you work as a correspondent in obviously incredibly dangerous places like Afghanistan and Belfast?
Yeah, so it's interesting. So, you know, a bit like David Tyson, I was no elite warrior, you know. I spent 10 years in the Navy. Three of those years were at university because I had, you know, I did Dartmouth and basic officer training. Then I went to Oxford for 3 years on a sponsorship and studied modern history, and then came back in for sort of 6.5 years. And I felt that my naval career, you know, I joined after the Falklands. The Gulf War happened when I was there, but I was based in Scotland. I tried desperately to get involved, but they managed to win it without me. And so I felt that my, you know, naval career in a way was sort of sailing around to lots of nice places. And that's one of the reasons why I left, because, you know, the Cold War was over and, you know, it seemed like what was the point? And I want, you know, still had this sort of thirst for adventure. And I ended up getting it from journalism. It was interesting because you would think it was a very, very different kind of line of work. And there would be, you know, it would be like two different worlds. And it is, but I actually found the transition relatively easy because I felt that a lot of the things that I'd done in the Navy, I was also sort of doing as a journalist. So I was dealing with people from admirals to, you know, ordinary sailors, and having to get on with people and build a rapport My job was changing in the Navy every couple of years. I was going into unfamiliar situations, unfamiliar places, and sort of making do. And I felt that was very much, you know, what I did as a journalist. The Navy, a lot of things are kind of reactive. Stuff happens and you deal with it. You're told what to do. You know, I was told what to do by editors. Stuff happened as a news journalist, and I just got on with it. But I do think that, you know, certainly in those days and even now, you know, relatively small number of military veterans go into journalism. And it did mean for me that I understood the system. I knew what an officer was. I knew what a sergeant was. I could understand why people wanted to join the armed forces. I could understand why people wanted to go to war and kind of enjoyed it. And so I think it gave me, you know, sort of empathy and, you know, a bit of a sense of credibility that I wasn't just some kind of pencil neck that gone from, like, you know, public school to university and then straight into Fleet Street. You know, I'd sort of lived a bit of something like their life.
I mean, it's been an incredible adventure. What are the abiding memories of your time serving? I mean, you rose the rank of flag lieutenant to the second Sea Lord and were posted with the assault ships. I read that you helped to transport reindeer with the Norwegian Navy.
I did. You know, it was a lot of fun. So the rank was lieutenant. The job, so which is like captain in the army. The job was flag lieutenant. So it was quite a good, I didn't have a business card, but flag lieutenant and assistant secretary, brackets personnel to the second Sea Lord, chief of naval personnel. That was kind of the job. And, but, you know, in some ways I was a glorified bag carrier. You know, I was his personal assistant. I did a lot of staff work. I staffed honors and awards, promotions. But I traveled around the world with him. We went to Hong Kong. We went to the Falkland Islands, went all over the UK. I had two admirals. You know, that was, you know, it was interesting because I had a window into power as well, because, you know, I went to a meeting with one of the admirals and Chris Patton in Hong Kong, for instance. And, you know, we were VIPs in the Falkland Islands and went to Northern Ireland on like an official visit. And we had all these kind of high level intelligence briefings and stuff. And so, you know, it was fascinating. I mean, life on board a ship is great fun. You know, I mean, I twice joined ships in Hong Kong, twice went round Australia. The second ship that I joined in Hong Kong was HMS Edinburgh, and Lieutenant His Royal Highness the Prince Andrew was one of the lieutenants on board. I was a sub lieutenant, and so, you know, we went all around Australia during the bicentennial in 1988 with Prince Andrew, or H as we called him, on board, and Fergie following us around. So, you know, it was interesting.
And 25 years in journalism, I mean, that's an incredible career already.
Well, yeah, so it's funny, you know, I feel like I was surfing a wave, really, because I started, you know, age 28 in 1994 in the Telegraph newsroom. So I kind of got my foot in the door. I did theatre reviews and obituaries and things. And I got my foot in the door because a guy called Gordon Ducker, who was the night news editor at the Express, an RAF reservist, I was talking to him. Vividly now, he had a dinner in Greenwich, and I was like, you know, how do I get into journalism? How do I break in? I don't have any connections, don't have any, you know, family history of this, because it seems full of sort of nepotism. And he was like, oh, well, you know, you've been in the services, you know, you don't want to go to journalism school or the regions unless you have to, because if you do, then you just, you know, you need to catch up time. So if you could kind of miss out that step, that would make sense. And the best way to do that is to get on a diary. You know, all these diary columns, you know, Times Diary, Telegraph had the Peterborough column. And he said, oh, you know, Max Hastings is editor of the Telegraph. You know, he's very pro services. So why don't you try Peterborough at the Telegraph? So I thought, oh, that's a good idea. And so I wrote to Quentin Letts, who's, you know, still around. He was the editor of Peterborough. And he, you know, he sent me a letter. So one thing I did, which was very foolish, is I immediately offered to work with no pay. Never do that, because it will be accepted. And Quentin enthusiastically accepted my offer to work with no pay. But he sent me a letter back saying, you know, dear Lieutenant Harnden or whatever, you know, thank you for your letter. You know, if you'd be so kind as to contact my secretary, Maureen, you know, perhaps we could come in and have a chat. So that's what I did. And actually, Quentin agreed, if I brought in a story, I was paid. So that was a big incentive to bring in stories. And so at that point, I was still in the Navy, but I was on my way out, you know, sort of giving him my notice. I was sort of banished to Plymouth. And I used to drive up from Plymouth to London every weekend to work on Sunday nights, Sunday days for the Peterborough column for no money apart from contributions. And that was my foot in the door. And it's funny, at the time, I remember thinking like, oh, my foot's in the door, that's it. And that is, in a way, how it worked out. I mean, obviously now I would look at that and think like, well, that's an opportunity, but, you know, lots of people get to that stage and it doesn't work out. But I think my sort of assumption that it was all going to be okay was probably a good one to have, because, you know, obviously, you know, there were some bumps. You know, at one point, Max Hastings wrote me a letter saying, you know, I know I've promised you a contract, but we don't have the money. My suggestion is you go and work for a regional paper for a few years and then come back. And I talked to a friend who advised me to just ignore that and keep coming in. And that's what I did. And that letter was completely forgotten.
Isn't that absolutely amazing? How did you sort of progress through journalism then? Because you'd done the military career, you'd started off in newspapers. How did you end up, you know, this incredibly prolific, veteran, very well-respected foreign correspondent? Was that always going to be your destiny, or might you have ended up the railway?
Yeah, it's who knows? I mean, my plan going in, I didn't really have that much of a plan. I just wanted to write. And I didn't even particularly want to write news. But, you know, I got to the last three or four, I think, for a bursary with the Independent. And I was gutted that I didn't get it, because I, you know, I went to the interview and I sort of thought, you know, again, I guess, I don't know whether it was sort of arrogance or excessive optimism or whatever, but I thought, oh, I got the interview and, you know, there's probably 300 applied and they're giving, you know, five interviews for two places. Of course I'll get one. But I didn't. Actually, Decca Aikenhead, who I know you've had on the podcast, she got one of those places. So she edged me out. So who knows what it would have been like if I'd gone, you know, got a bursary at the Independent. But I guess I just wanted to write. And when I got to the Telegraph, Quentin said to me, oh, you know, how about news? And I thought, news? That sounds cool. That's the sharp end. You know, running around, covering murders, going to the scenes of bombs and stuff, exciting. So, you know, I got a trial on news and I immediately thought, this is great. This is really, really good, because it's not just writing. It's not just like thumb sucking. It's finding things out, talking to people. There's kind of logistics of it. And the kind of adrenaline kind of surge of getting the technology to, you know, back. This is back in the day, you know, trying to get your laptop connected to the internet and everything, or you had to dictate the copy down the phone line to a copy taker. And, you know, that was all, you know, there was a real rush from all that. And also I remember early on, I think when I was getting the trial on news, so Max Hastings interviewed me. And, you know, it was pretty intimidating. And he said, I remember him saying, so, you know, what would you like to end up doing? And I just said, well, foreign correspondent, you know. And partly I was playing to the audience, because obviously Max was a famous, you know, foreign correspondent, war correspondent, and made his name, you know, in the Falklands. But I feel like I remember thinking as I was saying that, like, yeah, foreign correspondent, that's the right answer for Max Hastings, but also pretty good thing to do. And so, fairly early on, I sort of had that in mind. And actually, Max Hastings wanted to bring me onto the Evening Standard to be their defense correspondent. And I didn't want to go to the Standard because it was a regional paper rather than a national paper. And also, I didn't want to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, I was quite happy with, you know, rolling into the office at 10:30, which was the sort of national newspaper sort of day, 10:30 to sort of 7 or 8 in the evening. And so, somebody said to me, you know, I said to people in the newsroom, I've got this offer from Max Hastings, you know, what should I do? And they were like, well, do you want to go? I said, well, not really. And they were like, well, okay, so you want to use it as leverage to get what you want here, but you need to kind of, you can't be too crass about it. You have to sort of be subtle. And so, so that's what I did. I said, you know, I've got this, I remember Sue Ryan, who was the Home News editor. I said, you know, Sue, I've got this offer from Max at Standard. I don't, you know, I was up front. I said, I don't really want to go. But, you know, I was just wondering, you know, how you saw things here, what what the future might be like. And she said, well, what do you want to, you know, what would you like to do? And so I said, because I was, you know, prepared for this, I said, you know, well, I'd like to be Middle East correspondent, which was completely outlandish. You know, I've been in journalism for sort of 2 years, or Northern Ireland. And she's like, we might be able to make Northern Ireland work. Because that was it. It was during the first IRA ceasefire, and it was seen as a sort of a story that was kind of on the way down. Although I had an inkling that it wasn't, because I'd already spent a few weeks out there sort of covering for Richard Saville, who was my predecessor, what became my predecessor. And so that was my big break. So I was sent to Northern Ireland. By the time I got there, this ceasefire had ended. In fact, I was in Canary Wharf when the South Quay bomb went off, I think February the 8th, 1996. So that was the end of the ceasefire. And I was, there was a wobble when I was worried that they might actually withdraw the offer because they'd want somebody more experienced out there, you know, with a sort of IRA campaign having resumed. But they did send me out there. And I think when I'd been in the newsroom, there'd always been this sort of feeling of like, oh, who's this weird guy that used to be in the Navy who doesn't know shorthand, you know, hasn't done hard news for a regional paper. You know, what do we do with them? And I would get the sense sometimes I was the last person, if something big was going on, that I was the last person in the newsroom to sort of be sent out because I just hadn't been tested in hard news. But going out to Belfast, I was the only person there and there were bombs going off and people being shot and all sorts of stuff. And I had to do it. And I think I very quickly showed that I could do it. And so that just took me to a new sort of level, really, that I was sort of a tested hard news journalist. And then it became, you know, as well as the IRA and loyalist terrorism and all the paramilitary stuff, there was also a lot of politics. And so I began writing a lot about politics because we had the Good Friday Agreement and we had the Tony Blair and the peace process and all the rest of it. And so that gave me another dimension. And, you know, then by this point, Charles Moore was the editor and he was very, very interested in Northern Ireland. And so that led to me going to Washington. Now, I'm not sure that that was the right position for me. In a way, I was a victim of my success in writing about politics because I wasn't especially drawn to politics. I don't have a deep love of politics. And I'd already turned down like being sent to the lobby in Westminster as a sort of a junior correspondent because I just thought I want real stuff, real people, you know, war, blood, guts, you know, that's more my thing. But I got sent to Washington and I was a little bit concerned that I was just, you know, writing about guys in suits in the Oval Office and on Capitol Hill. Then 9/11 happened. So the kind of the war came to me and the war sort of, you know, eclipsed the politics at that point. So, you know, this is kind of a long answer, but that's how it happened. And obviously a lot of luck and, you know, accident involved in all that.
And three books. I mean, you mentioned Northern Ireland there. Your book, Bandit Country, the IRA and South Armagh, led to the formation of the Smithwick Tribunal, which investigated whether there'd been collusion between the Irish police and the IRC officers regarding those 1989 murders.
So early on, so, you know, I loved the Northern Ireland story. I was completely immersed in it. You know, I was writing 6-7 days a week and I just sort of lived it. There was no kind of dividing line between my work life and, you know, my personal life. You know, I was drinking with cops and army officers and, you know, former IRA men, and dating got mixed up in it as well. And you know, it was just fantastic. But there was this place, South Armagh, that I was drawn to very early on because I'd been in the South in the Republic covering the IRA killed an Irish police officer, which is a huge story. This would have been, I think, around about sort of May, June 96. And then on the way back, another story broke, which was that the Metropolitan Police had, you know, flown over and were all sort of combing through South Armagh in sort of forensic suits. And they were, they'd made a number of arrests. And they were looking for evidence connected to the Docklands bomb, you know, where I'd been there for that. And I remember driving across the border and seeing this sign. It said Fork Hill, 7 miles. And I thought, okay, Fork Hill, I've heard of that. That's sort of, you know, near Cross Maglen. It's like IRA heartland. I'll just drive in and take a look. And I went, you know, drove along the road and it's like, you know, British soldiers in helmets and full, you know, camouflage and, you know, blackened faces and everything sort of, you know, in the undergrowth. There's these police everywhere, cops, Metropolitan Police cops and also RUC and the helicopters. And it was just like, it was like a war zone. And I thought, wow, this is incredible. This is part of the United Kingdom in name, but it's just like, it's sort of like, you know, enemy controlled territory, IRA controlled territory. And, you know, this is just a place apart. And so I started looking into it. And then, you know, Slab Murphy was IRA chief of staff. He had a farm on the border. There was an IRA sniper team that operated in South Armagh. In fact, there were two teams with like 50 caliber rifles, you know, taking out soldiers and police, sometimes from very long distance. And also the key element of this as well was that the bombs, the big bombs, including the Docklands bomb in London, were South Armagh operations. The bombs had been assembled in South Armagh, transported across the Irish Sea different ways. They were South Armagh operations. I thought, this is incredible, this place. And then I, you know, was friends with an intelligence officer there called Rupert Thornlow, who subsequently was killed in Afghanistan and was a central part of Dead Men Risen. But we would talk about, you know, there were six or eight families who were running South Armagh from the IRA point of view. I thought, well, where's the book on this? And there wasn't one. I thought, wow, why? And so that became Bandit Country. And again, it was kind of impertinent in a way of me just being so new to it all to just sort of think that I could write this book. But, you know, I think I did a pretty good job. It was just this, you know, incredible place. And it just gave me this sense, which has continued, that journalism is great. It's the first draft of history. And I, you know, I love doing it, but books are part of history. A book is forever. I mean, certainly there are books that, a lot of political books, I feel are like bumper stickers or, you know, news articles, and they're just kind of in the moment, you know, because you just buy it for that election cycle or whatever. But I don't want to write books like that. I want to write books that are forever. And I feel like Bandit Country is like that. I mean, it's 23 years, but it still gets cited. In fact, I saw it being cited in the Sunday Times this weekend, which is always very gratifying. And so while the journalism, you know, I didn't want to sort of quit and just write full-time books, which is a precarious existence anyway. And I wanted to, you know, I wanted to have that kind of buzz that the news gave me and, you know, a big newspaper to get me around the world and get me to places. But I also did have the bug of books. There've been 10 years between the first and second book, and then again, the second and third book. So I need to up my hit rate. So as well as giving me this sort of, you know, turbocharged kind of boost at the beginning of my journalism career, it also did set me on the road to writing books.
Tell us about Dead Men Risen. I mean, obviously you've set this in already in Afghanistan, but you let the Welsh Guards soldier stories, frankly, speak for themselves. Is PTSD something that interests you? I mean, you've obviously covered it for Panorama as well.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a good segue to use that American word, which I think has crept into the English language as well, from Northern Ireland. So Rupert Thornlow, who I mentioned, so he was a captain in the Welsh Guards in Northern Ireland, who I got to know and became, you know, he was a source, I guess, but he also became a good friend. So in those times in mid to late 90s in Northern Ireland. And I mean, he'd just been on the SAS selection course and he'd failed on weapons handling right at the last, the last minute. And so he was a bit bummed out about that, but he'd got this intelligence job, and he was in the job, actually, Robert Nyrack, who was a Grenadier Guards officer who'd been abducted by the IRA and murdered in 1977. And so I learned all about Nyrack, which was another kind of connection to, you know, the book in South Armagh and what became Bandit Country. But Rupert, you know, was on the fast track, a great guy, you know, highly intelligent, had a work ethic like no one else. And so, you know, fast forward to 2009, and he was the commanding officer of the Welsh Guards, Lieutenant Colonel. I knew they'd already lost. They were, you know, this was the summer of Panther's Claw and the height of the British casualties out there. And they'd already lost a platoon commander, Mark Everson, and company commander, Sean Birchall. And so I knew they were having like a hell of a time, you know, it was carnage. And then, you know, I remember I was on, I was in Iowa. I was doing a sort of a online project. We were going down the Mississippi. We were driving. We weren't on a boat. With Julian Simmons, who I'd been in jail in Zimbabwe with. And I've, you know, flipped open my laptop and there's a headline about Rupert Thornlow being killed. I was like, oh my God, you know. And so he was the first battalion commander to be killed in action since H. Jones of the Parachute Regiment in the Falklands in 1982. So it was a huge deal. It was national news. And I knew, not only did I know Rupert, but I'd known a guy called Charlie Antelm, who was a major, but was promoted to acting lieutenant colonel to take over from Rupert and flown out to Helmand. And also a guy called Ben Bathurst, who's now a lieutenant general, I believe. And I'd known his father. His father was Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Benjamin Bathurst, First Sea Lord, when I was in the Navy. And I knew him a little bit. And he put me in touch with his son, who'd been a company commander in Northern Ireland. So it was sort of just coincidental, but I knew several people in the Welsh Guards. And so I just contacted the regiment and just said, you know, there could be a book in this, because those three levels of casualties, you know, actually it was the first, they were the first battalion since the Korean War to lose platoon commander, company commander, battalion commander. And the Welsh Guard sort of bought into it. And so I went out there in the summer, early autumn of 2009 to sort of be embedded with them and do all the initial interviews. And that became Dead Men Risen. And so, you know, it was very personal to me because, you know, Rupert had been a friend, and but I just found the people unburdening themselves. You know, I mean, I very much wanted to integrate it with sort of the home front and families and Rupert's widow, Sally. And so, you know, went to interview her, and just sort of heartbreaking, you know, the effect it has on families and you know, what it does to those who are left behind. And then in the later stages of the research, you know, people, soldiers were starting to unburden themselves. You know, at the beginning, it was all, everyone's there, they've got a mission, it's all very sort of can do, you know, we can win this war, we can, you know, we can take this hill, we can change what's happening in Helmand. But, you know, a year later, people were starting to reflect on, you know, some of what they felt was sort of the senselessness of it. There were, you know, there were demons, and this had had a really kind of serious effect. And there was a guy called Dan Collins, Lance Sergeant Dan Collins, which is like the guard's rank of corporal, who, I mean, I remember being sort of in awe of him, because he'd been wounded twice. He'd had bullets bounce off his body armor. You know, he'd really been in the thick of it. And you know, he was a hero, legitimate hero. And he ended up hanging himself, you know, in a remote quarry in,
Wales.
And that led to kind of, there was the book, and then that led to the sort of panorama, which wasn't just about the Welsh Guards, but Dan was a sort of central figure in that documentary. And I mean, he'd just been treated appallingly, and sort of just kind of just left out there to just not quite rot, but, you know, he was just sort of left to his own devices. And you know, he'd recorded this video instead of a note. He'd sent videos to his girlfriend and his mother. And I just remember his mother gave us this video of Dan with, you know, he had like a camouflage kind of headdress on. He was in the woods. It was raining. He had tears streaming down his face, just saying goodbye to his mother, because he wanted to get away from hell, which was his term for Helmand. So, yeah, so the PTSD, which is a feature also of First Casualty, you know, the sort of invisible injuries, that became a you know, an area of interest for me too.
It's incredible. I mean, like most people, I'm so grateful to people who serve, because they're putting themselves in harm's way during, but then there's a lifetime of flashbacks, PTSD. I mean, it is, you know, they're ruining their lives so that we can live ours in peace. frankly.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of it's interesting. I speak to so many people about this. I mean, on one level, it's like we're an all volunteer force, and I know just from my own personality, you know, I grew up, you know, with my grandfather who fought in the Second World War showing me his medals, and I always had like a thirst for action and combat, which I never experienced in the Navy, you know, sort of to my regret. You know, in some ways, that's a sort of an immature way to look at things, although it's also the way young men usually often are. But I remember being in awe of some of the platoon commanders in Helmand, so young lieutenants who were leading platoons in combat and being awarded military crosses and being shot at and killing people, and thinking like, wow, this is incredible. It's something I've never experienced. But over time, you know, I hope I've matured, because I'm, you know, 56 years old. You know, I've realized that there are costs to that. You know, be careful what you wish for. I mean, not only can you lose your legs leading a platoon in Helmand, but you're going to live with what you've seen, what's been done to you, what you've done for the rest of your life. And I don't think that means that people who've served and people who've served in combat are sort of victims and we should feel sorry for them. But we should obviously look after them, and we should, you know, thank them and recognize them. You know, we should recognize, you know, what they have done in our name. I mean, we, as a, you know, whether you're in the UK or the US, we sent people to do this, whether you agreed politically with the exact policy at the time, this was sort of done in our name. And some of these things were really sort of dirty, ugly, nasty things that had to be done, or that the politicians and or we as a country decided should be done, and they bore the brunt of it. And so I find this a sort of a fascinating area, and it's, you know, certainly been very much part of, you know, my work as it's gone on.
You were elected president of your JCR at Oxford University in 1987. And many of your contemporaries are now running the country. You knew David Miliband very well. Ted Verity, you told me, was a big lefty back then in the day. Now, I don't know what he's doing now. Editor of some newspaper. I don't know which one it is. It might be an obscure one. Never heard of it. You know, little brother Ed made an appearance. You said Michael Gove was a decent bloke, and you didn't know Boris well, but he was there. I mean, tell us about your adventures.
Yeah, I mean, it was incredible. So, you know, I grew up in Manchester. My dad had been in the Navy and was an architect. So, you know, we weren't from down the pit or anything, but, you know, sort of middle class, you know, I didn't go to a public school. You know, it was a big deal to get to. I was the first person in my family to go to university. And so it was a big deal to get into Oxford. And, you know, do you remember Brideshead Revisited and the Dreaming Spires and all that stuff? And, you know, when I got there, it was sort of a bit like that. I mean, I remember actually Olivia Shannon, who was the daughter of Paul Shannon. She died from some kind of drug overdose. And I remember being there when the police were bringing her body out of Christchurch next door. And she was in a very kind of rarefied, you know, the term then was Sloan Ranger, like, you know, everything was Sloan. I mean, but she was like, you know, and that set was the social elite of the elite. But there was also student politics. And, you know, I remember being first introduced to David Miliband by somebody said, oh, this is David Miliband. He's going to be a Labour MP. And David, whose nickname was at the time was Donny, from Donny Osmond, because he looked like Donny Osmond with big white teeth and, you know, kind of cheesy smile and kind of slightly nerdy. And yeah, so David was the JCR president before me, the year before me, 86. And I think he was chair of the Labour Club. And he was, you know, he was seen as sort of Labour aristocracy in a way because of his father, Ralph Miliband. And I remember, we used to organise speakers. And I remember Ken Livingstone came along, was a friend of the family. And I wandered around Oxford with Ken Livingstone looking for somewhere that sold cream cakes. And we had Bruce Kent came. People subsequently used to say David Miliband had the brain the size of a planet. That was often written to things like that in the media. I think David was clever. He got a first. But the thing that stuck out to me about him was his incredible work ethic. I mean, he was very clean living, and, you know, he would be up at 7 o'clock in the morning reading the papers in the JCR, debating sort of political issues, sometimes with people who disagreed with him. I remember like Jonathan Peacock was one of them, who was a Tory who I think became a QC. So it was sort of no surprise to me really that David took the route that he did. But I do remember David's little brother, Edward, coming up for interview. So he must have been about 60, or maybe he didn't come up for interview. Maybe he just came up for a look around. And, I remember this like very young, you know, if we thought David was nerdy, then Ed was just, you know, orders of magnitude more nerdy. I remember the sense that David, you know, JCR president, first class degree, the right sort of politics. He was sort of beloved in the college from the dons and the sort of hierarchy. And I remember getting this sense, I think even at the time, that there's no way David Miliband's brother is not going to get in. You know, it's like he's got the golden ticket. And sure enough, Ed Miliband did get in. But it sort of just affected me the way I thought about the whole leadership contest. That Ed Miliband got into Corpus and Oxford on the coattails of his brother David. And so to then sort of knife him in the leadership contest, I don't know, I had a lot of feelings about that. And I think a lot of people who know David did and still do. But yeah, and there's all these other people. Like, so Boris Johnson was the president of the union, I think, in my third year, and was this sort of impossibly sort of glamorous character. I mean, I remember him. He had obviously had the same blonde hair, but it was much neater. It sort of like swept back. His girlfriend, Allegra Mostyn Owen, had been on the cover of Vogue. You know, I didn't have any girlfriends that had been on the cover of Vogue. You know, he was sort of living the dream, and, you know, the Bullington, I didn't even know about it, but, you know, the Bullington Club and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the Oxford Union Debating Society, which was, you know, seen as a track to Prime Minister. And then all these other characters, like Ed Davey was a JCR president, I think, at Jesus College when I was there. And Michael Gove, who was at Lady Margaret Hall, and it was also sort of union hack, who they're always called hacks, not journalists, but, you know, like operatives in the union. And I remember he was dating a girl at Corpus. And so I would see him occasionally, and he was always wearing a kilt. And I remember writing something in Charwell. I think it was a letter. Anyway, something in Charwell, the university newspaper, describing him as a plonker. And this always stuck with me. A few years later, so 1994, I was just breaking into journalism. I had my, you know, foot in the door at the Telegraph. But basically, I was just a guy who was a junior news reporter who wasn't even on a contract. He was just doing shifts. And there was some kind of party. Michael Gove was there. And so Michael Gove was quite a big deal at the time. As a journalist, he was working for the Today program. And he was, you know, one of their sort of correspondents. And he'd do these very witty sort of reports and stuff. And so I remember seeing Michael Gove and thinking, oh, shit, you know, I called him a plonker in print, you know, this is going to be a bit awkward. And then I spoke to him and he couldn't have been nicer. And he was just genuinely interested in me. So I told him, how are you? What have you been doing? You know, what's going on? I mean, he really wanted to talk and connect properly. And I, at that point, I had nothing to offer him. You know, I wasn't in any position to help him. He was much further up the career ladder than I was. And because of what I'd written about him, which I presume he hadn't forgotten, because who would forget that? It didn't matter to him at all. And so I've never really had any contact with him since, but I've always had this sort of soft spot for Michael Gove, who gets a horrendous press, that he's a really decent bloke, because he genuinely wanted to connect with me and talk to me as a person when I had absolutely nothing to offer. So kind of the opposite of the cliche of politicians, you know, who are only just, you know, out for what they can get and only, you know, sucking up to donors and people who can help them. So it was kind of interesting to, you know, get to know a bunch of these characters at Oxford.
Tell us how you ended up in Virginia. I mean, you live in a community which is home to many high-ranking military and Washington government officials. Is that a great base for you? I mean, tell us how you ended up there, but like, what's your analysis of American politics at the moment? It seems to be never more so politically and culturally polarized.
Well, yeah, so it's interesting. So I ended up here, so I'm just outside DC. So I'm about, you know, I could drive to Georgetown in 20 minutes on a good day, downtown sort of 35 minutes. But, you know, but it's Virginia. It's a it's a state. It's kind of coincidentally, I'm very close to CIA headquarters. So there's lots of, you know, retired intelligence officers, military diplomats. So, you know, when I first got to DC, I lived in Georgetown. So I've got two kids who are now 15 and 13. And when the second one was born, I decided, like, you know, Georgetown is just, it's just too claustrophobic. It's just not right for kids. So I did that sort of, you know, cliche thing of sort of moving out to the suburbs and, you know, ended up here. It's definitely a bit of a different perspective on DC. But in terms of politics, I've moved away from it. You know, I absolutely, you know, hate what this whole thing has become and the way people have become, the sort of ripping people down on Twitter, the sort of, you know, assuming bad faith. I mean, James Bloodworth on the podcast the other day, I thought, spoke very eloquently about this, you know, assuming bad faith on anybody that, from anybody that disagrees with you. And also the sort of the dominance of Trump. One of the first stories I did when I got to the US in 99 was covering Donald Trump, who was floating a run for the Reform Party. And I went to Little Havana, you know, full of Cubans in Miami to cover this clown, you know, who clearly in my mind was not going to run for president. But, you know, we just did a kind of a piss-takey type story about it. You know, to me, Donald Trump was always the sort of personification of the ugly American. And he was always the stereotype of Americans that I was trying to dispel for the British audience and British editors. And so, you know, holy shit, the guy became president, you know, in 2016. He actually did. I didn't think he was going to run. I didn't think he was going to win, like so many other people. And in a way, I think I had a lot of the building blocks to see that he certainly had a chance of winning. And I sort of kicked myself for being in that sort of, you know, mindset, I think, that I'd had in 1999, is this guy's not serious. And in many ways, he wasn't serious in many ways. I mean, he didn't think he was going to win, but he did. And then everybody just sort of went crazy. And to an extent, they'd gone crazy already. But, you know, CNN was wall-to-wall Donald Trump. And so, you know, the dirty little secret is Donald Trump loves the media and the media loves Donald Trump. They need each other. He's a creation of the media. And CNN did this sort of deal with the devil. They helped him become president by giving him so much coverage. And then they, you know, they sort of turned against him. I mean, they'd always nominally been against him, but they really turned against him and basically have, you know, their whole kind of business model is this guy's a racist and a fascist. And, you know, and anybody that has anything to do with him, you know, we sort of hate him. And it became like a Punch and Judy show. And then, you know, Trump would attack CNN and CNN would attack Trump. And, you know, the rest of the media pretty much, you know, was just divided into opposing camps. And so the old kind of formula of writing the news straight, being fair, which doesn't mean just both sides, and it doesn't mean just, you know, not, you know, just record its stenography or recording what people say rather than, you know, what the truth is or, you know, the meaning underneath what they're saying. It doesn't mean any of that. But we just kind of lost that. So journalists, you know, like the Washington Post, you know, democracy dies in darkness, you know, these kind of sort of pompous sort of slogans where journalists and news organizations decided that journalists needed to be combatants in this sort of culture war or political war or whatever you want to call it. And so the stories, you know, would be framed to take down Trump or cast the worst possible light on Trump or anything he was doing. And that's exactly what Trump wanted. I mean, in a way, the media became the caricature of them that Donald Trump had said before it was completely true. You know, so they sort of walked into the trap. And so it's just a huge kind of mess now. And so I'm very glad to be out of the day-to-day or even sort of week-to-week coverage of politics because it's just sort of so toxic. And as I've got older, I've realized that what I'm really interested in is sort of ordinary people, you know, who often have extraordinary characteristics, but ordinary people in extraordinary situations. So like David Tyson, you know, the CIA case officer in you know, Kalajangi Fort in 2001, you know, he's not a celebrity. He's not, you know, famous or, you know, but I'm much, much more interested in that sort of person than, you know, your guy that became the White House chief of staff or a senator or, you know, the chairperson of a House of Representatives committee. So I don't know, I'm kind of glad to be out of it and just sort of looking at it pretty much from the outside, really, albeit, you know, from within Washington.
Toby, that was a hugely interesting conversation. Thank you ever so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Paul. I really enjoy the podcast and it's been great to be on it.
Well, wasn't that amazing? It was created and produced by Podcast Partners. They're really lovely people and rather good at all this podcasting guff. Find out more at podcastpartners.com.